actually constitute our character. And according to our character, we do things. And whatever we do also affect our character. They are interrelated. Mutually, they enrich. So Nachiketa knew very well that heaven is not end of happiness. So he asked for the third boon. That's a very famous verse in the text. The verse is this. I shall explain in English. Eyam prati vichiksa manushi asti tyege na ayam asti di jayege edad vidya manushishta stoyaham varanam mesha varastritiyaka. The translation is this. Well, I want to ask you this fundamental question. What is the mystery of human existence? What is the mystery of death? And what is the mystery of life? Some people say with this death, with death, everything comes to an end. When this body perishes, that is the end of the story of human existence. And there are many other people who tell you, well, there something continues to exist. Something continues to exist. In fact, belief in the continuity of human existence is the greatest, is the most solid foundation of ethics and morality. It has been so for many centuries in many religious traditions. Plato believed in law of karma and in rebirth. Neoplatonists like Philo and Plotinus believed in law of karma and rebirth. They believed in cyclic existence of the cosmos and they also cyclic existence of the human life, individual life. So, we'll come to that later on another occasion. So, Nachiketa puts this question. Some people say, when I die, this is the end of the journey. Nothing more is left. So, according to some other thinkers, something continues to exist, even at the time of death. Please teach me this mystery. Nachiketa is actually asking for an explanation of the mystery of death. But remember, the answer to the to a question on the mystery of death and the answer to the question of the mystery of life are the same. Because what is death? Death is the end of this life. So the answer to both the questions can be the same. In answer to this question, the Lord of Death, who is a teacher in this particular philosophical work, gives a long exposition of the ultimate truths of yoga philosophy and Vedanta philosophy. In short, he tells Nachiketa, this body comes and goes. This mind also is not eternal. So mind is always a kind of in the form of a speculation. Intellect also changes. Anything which changes cannot be eternal. Now, only that can be called eternal, everlasting, which never changes. In fact, in yogic and Vedantic tradition, there are three criteria by which you can judge whether something is real in the true sense of the term. That is, if it is eternal or non-eternal. One criterion is this. If it remains unchanged in the past, present and future, then it is eternal. Second criterion is, it should be beyond time, beyond space and beyond causation. Anything which comes into existence sometime in the past will have to vanish sometime in future. So only that reality is real or eternal, which always existed. Therefore it cannot come into existence because it always existed. God is real because he never comes into existence because he always existed. This is accepted in many other traditions. Now, the third criterion is We should experience the same reality without any change in our waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. If you analyze from a superficial empirical point of view, in waking state, we experience things with our 5 senses of perception and 5 senses of action and mind. When we walk, we use our feet and we use our mind, we use our eyes. But in dream, we may be walking, but the act of walking, the light that we see in dream, is just a projection of mind. So there is always change in waking state, in dream state, and deep sleep state. This is true of all empirical phenomenal experiences. So the teacher of the Upanishad tells the boy, look here, that alone is real, which always remains eternal without any change. And what is that reality? That reality is immanent in all living beings. Immanent. In fact, if you just refer to the words, what the teacher of the Upanishad tells is this. This reality is present in the minutest atom and also in the largest cosmic phenomena. Anuhu, Aniyan, Mahato, Mahiya. Anu is Sanskrit term for atom. See, the teacher tells, this reality, the immanent reality as consciousness, as the fundamental supreme existence, as supreme knowledge, supreme bliss, what we call consciousness, is present in all living beings, everywhere, as the immanent reality. And the same reality is present in all external things as the all-pervading, omnipresent reality. So, this consciousness is all-pervading, it is also immanent. If a person dies, something leaves him, and even though his senses are perfectly alright, he cannot walk, he cannot see, something leaves him. What is that something? That is consciousness. And that consciousness makes him walk, makes him think, makes him live. So this consciousness is all-pervading. And it is also immanent, the indweller in all living beings. It is present in the most minute, the minutest of beings, and also in the largest, grandest of cosmic existence. The entire cosmos at the macro level is an expression of this consciousness. And all living beings also at the micro level is associated with this consciousness, which is the immanent reality residing in all living beings. And it is also transcendental. And how do we realize this? It's a path of yoga. How do we realize this? One important problem in the path of freedom is we often take the unreal for the real and real for the unreal. Put in another language, every moment our mind is being dragged towards external objects. If we are not very careful, if you are in an unguarded moment, every moment you find our mind is being dragged towards external objects. Now, human beings can pause for a moment, think and check and prevent a mind from being dragged into external objects. All other created beings are guided, they are regulated by instincts. So naturally their mind is being dragged into external objects. But man alone can have this freedom. But that is possible only if mind is able to control the senses. If the senses control the mind, then mind acts as a slave. That leads to spiritual slavery. If the mind can control the senses, then that leads to spiritual freedom. If the senses control the mind, that leads to slavery. So this is the central principle in Vedanta. So the teacher tells him, we can turn our inquiry inward, and we can purify our mind. And as we go on purifying our mind, we manifest the immanent reality more and more. And as we realize that the Supreme Reality, Consciousness, is present in all living beings, including ourselves, we realize the Supreme Truth. If any of you may be interested, it's interesting, if you read the works of the great 13th century German mystic, Meister Eckhart, you find many of his writings closely resemble the ideas explained in Vedantic text. The reality is beyond words. God cannot even be called God, because if you name God, you are defining it. So God as a supreme reality is beyond the word God. So it is an intuitive experience. And that's the true purpose of religious life. Such ideas you find, which are found in Upanishadic texts. So, Yama tells Nachiketa, the purpose of human life and the path to freedom is to experience this immanent reality within. And this is possible by doing good deeds, by speaking good words, and by thinking good thoughts. There are different paths, which we call yoga, which take us to this freedom, depending upon the spiritual seekers and aspirants. Four paths are normally prescribed in yogic tradition. Before that, I have to deal with two important concepts related to this before explaining the four paths. It's called Yama and Niyama, which are graphically explained by Patanjali in Yoga Sutras. Patanjali says there are 10 disciplines. Patanjali was a great writer of Yoga Sutra, in which he gives a description of the different steps for a yogi to practice. So he speaks of 10 disciplines. Some disciplines are general disciplines, some are specific disciplines. The first discipline that he insists on is Ahimsa, which we call non-violence. The first one, non-violence. One should be able to practice violence mentally, physically, and also verbally. So here, non-killing or non-hurting physically is not the whole of non-violence or ahimsa. Even the very idea of violence is to be avoided. It becomes violence. There is no distinction between a violent thought and a violent deed, so far as a spiritual seeker is concerned. So non-violence or ahimsa is a total philosophy of life. Because this ideal is based on the intuitive experience that the entire creation is one spiritual family, one human family. There is no distinction. The whole creation, the whole existence is one. Unity of existence from a spiritual point of view, not from a conceptual point of view or an ideological point of view, but from a spiritual point of view. Because we experience the entire humanity is spiritually one. And this is the sign of a great spiritual seeker. Either he believes in a God, he's a devotee of God, or he's a great philosopher, seeking the supreme truth, whatever may be his position. The experience of the entire creation in himself, the experience of the presence of the entire creation, universe, in himself, and the experience of the presence of himself in the whole creation. This is the sign of the highest devotee of God and the highest yogi, and also this is the sign of a person who has attained spiritual freedom, because it is based on the idea of non-violence. The creation is one, existence is one. Even non-believers in God have a place in God's empire. That is the special characteristic of this Vedanta philosophy. So, the first principle is non-violence, based on not the philosophy but experience of the fact that creation is one, existence is one. So, it's not only philosophical concept, it is also highly humanistic concept. It's a kind of universal spiritual humanism. Creation is one, existence is one. Not only human beings, animal kingdom also. So, one should be completely free from any thought, word or deed related to violence. This first one. The second principle with Patanjali, the great teacher of yoga, prescribes is truthfulness. These are all interrelated. If a spiritual seeker gets really well established in one of these first set of niyamas, first disciplines, he gets equally well established in all other four disciplines as well. So satya. What is satya? Satya actually means truth, truthfulness. Keeping mind, that is thought, word and deed in one line. What we think, that we do, and the same thing we speak. This is truthfulness in its most perfect form. So, any spiritual seeker who experiences the presence of the entire universe within himself and his own presence in all living beings cannot be untrue, cannot practice untruth in his interactions with other human beings. Now, one point which the great philosophers of yoga and Vedanta insist is this. It is not a belief, it is not a doctrine, it is not a dogma. Because all these philosophical works emphasize one point: we cannot explain the supreme truth. We can only experience supreme truth. We can only realize the supreme truth. All these books, the book which I mentioned earlier, all these self-philosophical works, one point which they insist, they repeat again and again, is all these books are very useful for us to understand the wrong conceptions so that we can avoid them. But the real truth, the real experience is to be experienced, and experience can never be explained. You know, experience is beyond words. Even if you want, if you drink a cup of coffee, the taste of coffee cannot be expounded, experienced, cannot be explained or defined or described. It's beyond words. So, spiritual experience is beyond books, beyond words, beyond rituals. But at the same time, these books are very important because these books do teach us that experience is the only language of experience. Experience is the only language of spirituality, not belief. So, when a spiritual seeker gets fully established in this ideal of non-violence, he also gets established in the ideal of truthfulness. And then the third one is, he is non-stealing, that is a translation into English, but it means non-covetousness. You have complete freedom from greed. And then purity of mind, purity of life, brahmacharya, and complete freedom from any kind, any desire, any want. That means complete freedom from accepting gifts, it is called. Now, if a person, if a spiritual seeker, in his attempt to get spiritual freedom, gets established in these ideals, then the first sign of that person is he be satisfied. Satisfied is not the right word, it's contented. Because satisfaction normally means the feeling, well, I have got, I want to buy, if well, I want to buy a book, I have got a book. That becomes, the feeling is satisfaction. But a book may, we may lose that book, the book tomorrow. The book is something perishable. The book is not eternal. So, this satisfaction is short-lived. When we lose the book, then dissatisfaction becomes dissatisfaction. So anything empirical, anything world which belongs to this world, anything that we can buy with money or material things, cannot give us eternal satisfaction, can give us only temporary, momentary satisfaction. But real satisfaction is the satisfaction which is eternal. When we feel that I have gained something, there is nothing beyond this that I should see, that I should look for. Complete contentment. This contentment is the first sign of a person who has sincerely started his search for freedom, spiritual freedom. Because the moment we really, sincerely start the search for freedom, that moment we start feeling this inner contentment. And contentment is based on another characteristic called Shauja, means purity. So, all these characteristics give us a feeling that we are perfectly contented. The feeling comes that there is nothing beyond this that we can look for. In fact, that is the first sign of a person who is sincerely trying to seek spiritual freedom. And also the person who has attained spiritual freedom. This idea of spiritual freedom is mentioned in all religious books. For example, Nirvana, concept of Buddhists. And then I and my father are one this idea of Christian tradition. And then the idea of spiritual liberation in Hindu tradition. And many of these traditions you find great mystics who have gone beyond books, beyond rules, beyond rituals, beyond conventions and conformities. And who have tasted a little bit of this intuitive spiritual experience, which we call freedom. I have tried to give a brief outline of some of the basic concepts as a kind of introduction today. Now we will have half an hour long interaction, and when we exchange ideas during the interaction, we can explain. We can give more detailed explanations of some of the ideas which are only hinted in this talk. So, any subject, any topic.
I'm not particularly concerned about an afterlife, heaven,
yes.
What happens after death. It doesn't really interest me. What I'm trying to figure out is how to live the life that I have in the way that not should, but could, or what is achievable?
Yes. Yes. Well, belief in rebirth, in heaven, is not essential to practice yoga. But in this life itself, we can divert our faculties, our tendencies, our capabilities, use creative channels that bring joy to ourselves and also to other living beings around us. That itself is enough. In fact, in yogic and Vedantic tradition, they don't insist on belief in rebirth or karma theory, not at all. No belief is thrust or insisted, emphasized. One may believe, one may not believe. In fact, if a spiritual seeker tries to lead a good life, that is enough. Because freedom doesn't come from outside. Freedom is within. This freedom means realization of the fact that we are not just these psychophysical mechanisms, we are actually the consciousness itself. This realization is freedom. For that we don't have to believe in heaven, rebirth or anything. Leading a good life, sincere, honest life, that itself will help us to bring out this inner freedom within. But normally all of us, all thinking people feel a kind of discontent with whatever is happening around us. No? We have a feeling that, well, there is something better than this that I can achieve. The idea of perfection from which we are coming and the perfection towards which we are going, this is common in many religious traditions. But often we feel this discontent is an expression of the state of imperfection that through which we are going right now. So, if we can lead a good life through good deeds and bring out the inner consciousness, that is enough. Because freedom cannot and doesn't come from outside. Freedom is within. We are inherently free. Then why do we feel that we are not free? That's because we forget the fact that we are free. If freedom is something that you gain, that freedom cannot be eternal. So spiritual life is rediscovery of our true nature. It is not getting a new knowledge. It is rediscovery of our true nature. In fact, unless we are inherently free, we won't have the feeling, well, I feel something wrong with me. There is something. You see, paradise lost, paradise gained. In all religious traditions, mystical traditions, you find the concept of perfection at the beginning, and then the idea of falling away from that state of perfection, losing that state of perfection. And all the spiritual practices are meant for regaining that state of perfection. Which means perfection is within. So any sincere spiritual seeker who may not believe in any religious traditions, who wants to lead a good life, through that you can find many people achieve spirituality. Gandhi, for example, Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi was a spiritual man. Well, he was a religious person in the normal sense, but he didn't regularly visit temples or places of worship. So, spiritual freedom goes beyond religious traditions. It goes far beyond religious traditions. Even those who do not believe in religions can be spiritually free. And many who openly, outwardly believe in religions may not be necessarily spiritually free. So spiritual freedom, true freedom, goes beyond our beliefs or dogmas or doctrines. That's the idea. Many great men who led very good lives in this world, highly spiritual, not necessarily believers in any conventional religious traditions. Many were believers, many were not believers. Because spiritual freedom goes beyond religious convictions. It is not contrary to religious convictions, but goes beyond religious convictions. That's the idea.
What do the teachings tell us about, maybe this is something in future lectures, about the proper balance between our individual spiritual freedoms and the ethical imperative of all these traditions to advance the economic and political freedoms of everyone.
So economic freedom, ethical freedom, political freedom, they do have a place. They do have a relevance, no doubt about it. But even in countries and societies which are economically free, politically free, and socially free, enjoying a lot of social freedom, political freedom, there are great thinkers and seekers who look for a higher kind of freedom. And then there is another ethical idea behind, you know. Well, as I said earlier, religion, conventional religion, cannot enforce ethics and morality on a society. Suppose somebody tells you, well, I don't believe in God, I'm ready to go to hell. What's the basis of ethics for such a person? Humanism, interaction, social, cooperation. So, but then there is a higher ethical principle. Humanity is one. Creation is one. You cannot hurt another person without simultaneously hurting yourself, because creation is one. In fact, this is the core of yogic and Vedantic philosophy. They believe the unity of existence. So, here you find the idea of unity of existence becomes the most solid foundation of universal ethical principles. Of course, this is possible for a society which is highly evolved. Normally, we will need police system and law enforcement system. We will need certain systems to enforce ethics and morality. But at a higher level, this is a higher spiritual ethics, which is universal, which is not based on national constitutions, laws, so which is spiritual, which is based on the idea that spiritually humanity is one, not only humanity, creation is one. That's the idea behind, which becomes the most solid foundation of universal ethics. But this, as I said, you know, this is possible only for a society or a nation which is highly evolved. So only great mystics who were studied, and also those who were non-mystics but who led very good life, they practiced some kind of universal ethical principles. I gave the example of Gandhi, Buddha. Buddha did not believe in God. Buddha was not an atheist. But he was agnostic. He didn't worry much about metaphysical or spiritual ideas. But he insisted that we should lead a very good life in this world. He was one of the greatest spiritual personalities the world has produced. So, there have been great religious leaders who were great spiritual personalities. There have been great spiritual personalities who perhaps did not believe in God. As Buddha is an example. Vartamana Mahavira is a founder of Jaina religion. Is another direction. I hope it's clear.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is the main difference between Buddhism and Vedanta?
Oh, yes. Now, there are four systems of thought in related Buddhism. It's called Sautrantika, Vaibhashika, Vijnanavada, and Shunyavada. Two schools of idealism, two schools of realism. Sautrantika and Vaibhashika are two schools of realism, and Vijnanavada and Shunyavada is called the doctrine of emptiness, and it is a subject to idealism. It's called Vijnanavada. They come very close to Vedanta. So, I hope this audience won't mind if I become too pedantic and academic. So, I should explain this. In Vijnanavada, there are two developments. The earlier Vijnanavada, it is called earlier Vijnanavada. The later Vijnanavada school is called Sotantra Vijnanavada. The earlier school was known as Alaya Vijnanavada. Vijnanavada is a school of subjective idealism, one of the two idealistic thought systems of later Buddhism. In the early Vijnanavada, in the earlier school of Vijnanavada, they believe in a mind, but they call chittam, which is the eternal subject, and everything else in this world is unreal. The unreality is experienced by the eternal subject. That was the doctrine of the earlier Vijnanavada. It comes very close to Vedanta. In Vedanta, Brahman or Atman, soul, consciousness, is the eternal witness subject. So you find a striking similarity between the teachings of the earlier Vijnanavada, Arya Vijnanavada, and Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta. Then the second school of idealism was Nagarjuna Shunyavada, the doctrine of emptiness, is known as Mahayana Buddhists, both were Mahayana Buddhists. Their teachings come very close to Vedanta, but Nagarjuna, the author of the fundamental book of the doctrine of emptiness, took a negative turn. He says Shunya is the ultimate reality, but Shunya is empty. So who enjoys the blissfulness? The Nirvana. So the question was not answered. But earlier Vijnanavada, early Vijnanavada, comes very close to Vedanta, comes to Advaita. The later Vijnanavada, Swatantra Vijnanavada, it belongs to Asanga and others, later Vijnanavadins, they said subject and object both are unreal. So that became vulnerable, that's a departure from Vedantic tradition. You clear it? Thank you.
What's the fundamental point on which we can say this is real and that is unreal?
Excuse me?
What is the determining factor between
real or unreal
and what is not real?
As I said, you know, there are three criteria in Vedantic tradition to decide whether something is real or not. See, everything in this world is real, relatively real. The world, this is the earth. Before Big Bang, it did not exist. And after Big Crunch, it may not exist, if you believe it. So it's a matter of a few millions of years, perhaps. Many millions of years. Before the earth was created, it did not exist. So there was a time when it did not exist. And there will be a time when it will not exist. Which means it is relative. An insect may live for a few minutes. Earth lives for millions of years. Both are equally relative. So when we talk about unreality, we are talking about the relativity. We are not talking about things which are totally unreal. That point should be understood. Because we are not talking about things which we cannot conceive of at all. We are talking about things which do exist in front of us, of which we are a part as this world. But when we closely analyze, we understand, well, it goes on changing. And what is changing is real, but relatively real, not absolutely real. Then what is the absolutely real? The absolutely real is the thing which existed before came into existence. It means it cannot come into existence. And it will exist, it will continue to exist, even after it ceases to exist. What is that? Something which never comes into existence because it always exists. That is, in Vedantic tradition, it's called consciousness, as in English we call it Atman Brahman. Atman we call it because that consciousness is immanent in all of us, inherent. There is something within us, with use of life. It is also omnipresent, alternating. But then we can't say it is pantheistic. So we call it transcendental also. Beyond words, beyond books, beyond descriptions and definitions, which can only be experienced. And the great spiritual personalities the world has produced have experienced this. Both believers and also non-believers. As I said, Buddha was one of the greatest spiritual personalities the world has. He experienced this. So there are three criteria.
are they to help practice, you know, asana, pranayama, meditation? Why are they so important? And do you have any recommendation on how to teach them to other people?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
There is a very, very important question for any student of Hatha Yoga, yoga asanas. See, one point that is stressed is, you know, that is emphasized is this. When we practice yoga asanas, we generate energy. Our nervous system, body system, but mind also gets energized, invigorated. If you do pranayama, still much more energy generated. We become more active. Now, if we practice yogasanas and pranayama before getting fully established in non-violence, what happens? This extra energy and heat generated will make us violent. You see, if you give a lethal weapon to a person who is naturally violent, he becomes much more destructive. And again, if a person practices this yogasana and all that, pranayama, especially pranayama, before getting fully established in non-stealing or contentment, he may become greedy. And if he practices all this before he's established in some kind of sense control, he may become a profligate. And see, that's why Patanjali and the commentators on Patanjali Yoga Sutras, Bhoja Vritti and Vyasa Bhashya, both are the important books. And also some of the commentators on two Hatha Yoga, two books related to Hatha Yoga, Gheranda Samhita and Hatha Yoga Pratibhita. They insist that one should be very careful by practicing any asana which involves inversion of the body. Shirsasana, for example. Blood will be flowed, blood will become much more vigorous. So, nervous system gets more energized. Now, when the nervous system gets energized, our natural tendencies will become more active, they become hyperactive. So, by the practice of non-violence, by the practice of non-stealing, by the practice of purity of life, we are blocking the doors through which the energy may flow towards negative channels. I hope it's clear. When we get established in non-violence, there is no scope for the extra energy to flow towards violent tendencies. See, so the flow of energy towards violent tendencies, to undesirable channels, will be blocked or prevented by getting established in the idea of non-violence. So if a person becomes non-violent, then he can practice asana and pranayama, and this extra energy will help him to continue ashtanga yoga. Yamana, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. It becomes a fuel for the seeker which will take him to the last destination, samadhi. Otherwise, the seeker may fall by the wayside. He may have deviations because the extra energy produced by the practice of asana and pranayama may divert him and may deviate him away from the proper channel. I hope it is clear?
Yeah. Hi. What is the difference between Hinduism and Vedanta, or is Vedanta a branch of Hinduism?
Oh,
can
yeah.
you explain the interplay?
Yes. No. Vivekananda, who brought Vedanta to America, said once, from the highest flights of Vedanta philosophy to the lowest fetishism, the gnosticism of the Buddhist the atheism of the Jains, each and all have a place in Hindu's faith. These are his own words. Now, here in this sentence, Vivekananda defines Vedanta as the finest fruit, the highest reach of Hindu philosophy. But remember, he also said this Vedanta is a universal religion. So, in that respect, Vedanta is not part of what we call popular Hinduism. But Vedantic teachers were born in Hindu tradition. And Hindu tradition itself accepts this universal trans-Hindu Vedantic concept. But then one can practice Vedanta without becoming a Hindu. No, there is no need for anyone to become a Hindu to practice Vedanta. Anyone can practice, Christian, Jew, anyone can practice Vedanta. There is no need for you to be a Hindu to practice Vedanta, because that way Vedanta is universal in its application and also in its philosophy. I hope it's clear. As I said, Buddha was not a Hindu, but he was a great Vedantin. In fact, the teachings of the most profound Hindu philosophical works insist that Vedanta is a universal religion. It goes beyond the belief systems, faith systems, temple worship, or all the other trappings of popular Hindu religion. That's it.
I'm not sure you've finished the story of Nachiketa.
I know, I will continue that. I gave out of the third book, and in answer to the third book, Yama, the teacher, was not actually willing to teach him immediately. He tries to test him. That's because that I did, it becomes a story. Too long a story. Anyway, I shall explain a few more points. So when Nachiketa asked for the third boon, which is closely related to the highest Vedantic teachings, Yama tried to persuade him. First, see, you ask for any other boon, I can give kingdoms, countries, empires, and all other objects of enjoyment. But then, ultimately, when Yama gave a long list of other options, Nachiketa gave one, he replied in one sentence, let's see, Tavayava Vahastava Gurtya Givi. The idea meaning is this, Yama told him, I shall give you a dancing girls, empires, kingdoms, comforts, everything, and long life. Then Nachiketa said, all this you take for yourself. I want only the answer to this question. Then Yama was really happy because he found this boy deserved to be taught this highest truth. And then he taught him. See, he explained life. Atmanam vidhyanti shariram vidhameva buddhim tu sarathim vidhi manah pragrahameva. She explains, the whole human life is a journey. You're traveling by a chariot. And consciousness, Atman, is the person who is traveling. Now, this chariot is the body. Now, who is the charioteer? Who drives the chariot? Is intellect. And then, the reins, mind. And horses, our senses of perception, senses of action. Now, if the charioteer, the one who drives the chariot, is sensible, if he has self-control, if he has inner discipline, this journey will take you to your destination. Otherwise, you may end up reaching somewhere else. So therefore, one should practice the wisdom, proper discrimination. Discrimination is wisdom, discerning mind, and then it will take you to the highest destination. And when you reach your destination, you will understand that this Atman, this consciousness, is present in the most minutest of beings, and also in the largest of the large. And this realization is possible by turning inquiry inward and leading a disciplined moral thinking life. And the instruction continues.
The idea of Om, we hear the Om being chanted all the time, especially in popular circles in yoga and other venues. Can you share where does Om originally go in the scriptures? Where does Om come from? And what is the metaphor of the actual shape of the symbol itself?
This Om is called Pranava. It is expounded very graphically in one book. It's called Mandukya Upanishad. It's a very small book, only 12 verses. There's a long description of the practice of Om. Om is a symbol of the absolute reality. In Sanskrit language, Om consists of three syllables, A, U, and Ma. So A is pronounced with open mouth open, and Ma is pronounced with mouth closed, and U is pronounced with mouth half open or half closed. Now, all human sound systems are confined in this mechanism. When we pronounce something with mouth completely open and completely closed, and also in between these two, it incorporates all possible human sound systems. Everything that you can think of, you can name. Now, whatever you find in this world, you can never think of any object in this world without a corresponding name. You may tell me, well, I saw something in the market, the name of which I do not know. Then you will tell me, well, I saw something, the name of which I do not know. That is its name. So you can never think of any object in this world with a corresponding verbalization. An attempt to name it or define it or refer to it in words. So the entire cosmos, the entire existence is contained in Om. Om is symbolic of the entire existence. Whatever you think of, you have to think of some name, some sound. And all the entire sound system, speech system, is contained in Om. As I said, A-U-Ma. So, Om, in other words, is symbolic of whatever you see around you, the entire existence, and whatever is beyond you. That is also included in Om. Because Om begins with silence, it ends in silence. The silence is indicative of the transcendental. Now, Om itself is indicative of the empirical. In other words, the Om is symbolic of the entire existence, and the entire cosmic reality. If a spiritual seeker utters this word Om with mind fully concentrating on this particular aspect, that Om includes entire existence, he also becomes universal. He starts feeling the presence of the universal or pervading reality within him. So great sages reach the highest spiritual entity experience and experience unity between the seeker and the sought by the practice of this. It's called Pranava Upasana, means Omkara Upasana, the practice of Omkara as a spiritual practice. Repeating this mantra as a spiritual practice.
Does the actual shape, I My understanding
that oh, yes. That is Deva, that is Devanaga.
The of consciousness and Maya.
That is a later discussion.
A later dis-
and please remember, you know, the letter that you normally find today, it is associated with Devanagari script. This script actually is a later version. In its original form, it is Brahmi script. So you find in Ashoka's edicts, you don't find Omkara written in this way. It is a slightly different. It's the earlier form of this script. It's called Brahmi script. So in ancient times, these words and these letters were not written. They were taught by the sages to their disciples who practiced it by listening. You know, all these Upanishads, all these technical books, Upanishad philosophical books, where Omkara is explained, they are called Shruti in Sanskrit. Shruti means something that you learn by hearing. So they were never written, they were taught orally and learned orally and practiced like that. They took the written form only in recent times. Next class, next Tuesday, 22nd January. So thank you.